in the limelight.
Iran will not hesitate to defuse the dangers to the region posed by the weapons of mass destruction of dastardly states if they continue with their inhuman policies of the slaughter of the innocents, says Kayhan, international staff writer, in an article published under the heading, Iran's Means of Defense Proves Commitment to Peace. Stay tuned for more. Islam is the religion of peace, and true Muslims never resort to violence and bloodshed, especially those in power and possessing the might and means, as well as the technology to develop state-of-the-art armaments. The weapons, however, they produce are not meant for initiating wars and occupation of other lands, but as deterrents against would-be invaders and for defending their faith, country, and interest when wars are imposed by aggressors and terrorists. As the Noble Quran says, prepare against them whatever you can of military power and war horses, awing thereby the enemy of Allah and your enemy and others besides them who you do not know but Allah knows. True to the divine commandment, the Islamic Republic of Iran, which was the victim of a devastating eight-year war in the 1980s, imposed by the U.S. through Saddam of the repressive Ba'ath minority regime of Baghdad, spared no efforts to upgrade its means of defense in order to save the country, but never resorted to the use of any weapons of mass destruction that would kill innocent people. Even when the cowardly enemy bombed Iranian combatants and border civilians with the internationally banned chemical weapons supplied by the West. This is ample proof of Iran's firm adherence to the Almighty Creator's injunctions, as the Noble Quran says, whomever kills a soul without its being guilty of manslaughter or occupation on the earth, is as though he had killed all mankind, and whoever saves a life is as though he had saved all mankind. Thank God, today Iran has succeeded in building a formidable array of the most sophisticated weapons that have proved their mettle against the military hardware of the big powers in the wars ignited in the region by the Zionist entity, the terrorists, and the American client regimes. Iran, which has mastered the nuclear fuel cycle for peaceful purposes and in spite of being fully capable of assembling warheads, has ruled from a position of strength that use of weapons of mass destruction is haram or religiously forbidden, has every right to defend itself through possessing effective means of deterrence in order to discourage the cowardly regimes from taking undue advantage of the Islamic Republic's humanitarian policy by threatening it with the unconventional weapons in their arsenals. In other words, Iran will not hesitate to defuse the dangers to the region posed by the weapons of mass destruction of dastardly states if they continue with their inhuman policies of the slaughter of the innocents.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program Islamic Upbringing. This is a program wherein we provide you with necessary information to be able to provide necessary grounds for your children to flourish and to attain perfection, which is the ultimate goal of Islam. Well, today in our studio we have with us Brother Miqdad. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Brother Miqdad is a researcher in the Hafza Ilmi of Qom, who will be providing us answers on the basis of Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. A very warm welcome, brother.
Thank you so much. Jazakallah.
Brother, in our previous session, we could not conclude our topic. We were talking about when teenagers pay a lot of attention to themselves. Is that okay? You said it's okay to pay attention to oneself, but when that exceeds, especially in terms of paying attention to the physical body, it may be a matter of concern for parents. And then we were talking about what is common in society, what social media has put into the minds of young boys and girls, and that's like looking perfect physically, and you said that's a matter of concern again.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So we left off last discussion talking about the role of social media and generally society in making us think and making youth think that body image is what matters in our success.
Yes.
This is a very, very important discussion, extremely important discussion, especially in today's age. And so I strongly recommend parents out there, mothers, fathers out there, to go and research this a bit more in their free time. There's plenty of books out there. The impact of selfies, for example, in body image and self-esteem. The role of social media in our self-image, in our self-esteem. All of these things you'll find are related very closely to this topic that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
How do we deal with it? So first and foremost, let's just kind of dig a bit more. So what happens is that society and social media specifically brings about this idea that if I want to be successful today, and if I want to be accepted within society, right, I have to have a very strong body image.
Yes.
And I have to be presentable and beautify my physical appearance. And this is why boys and girls would do things related to the physical appearance, whether it's to do with their hair, whether it's to do with their makeup, whether it's to do with their just general dressing, etc. Now, remember, when I say beauty over here, I don't necessarily mean beauty the way we understand it. Beauty that matches the current fashion, you would say.
Yes.
What happens is that, and this is a discussion in psychology as well, and mental health especially, is that this is known, and so it's been researched plentiful as well. It's known to be a very big factor in a lot of mental health issues as well, because you're always chasing something that will never be achieved.
Okay.
And you find that a lot of, especially girls, go through a lot of trouble and a lot of efforts, a lot of expenses.
Pain, cost.
Yeah. In order to kind of fit in, but never realize that, because there has been an idea of a perfect body being created in people's minds that is not achievable by everybody.
Yes.
And all teenagers try to chase that, and they have these role models of this perfect body, thinking that this is what will lead me to be accepted, lead me to be successful, not realizing that this is actually detrimental. This actually causes them more harm than good.
And I think one more example is that, I mean, all the family members I have, especially girls in the teens, I have, if like, since I am living very far away from my country, and then we would sometimes want to share pictures, like they would want us to send pictures, and we would want them to send the pictures, especially the teenage girls would never send their pictures without filters or without using beauty cameras. And that's, I think, one of the reasons that you already mentioned. Why do they do that? Brother, I'll continue this discussion with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5 years old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English Radio at irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. We're talking on an important topic, what social media has got to do with the teenagers pay excessive attention to their bodies. What role does social media play over here? So, brother, you were talking about that.
So how do we deal with this? A couple of points that parents should take care of. One, first and foremost, is to really strongly work on the confidence of the children or the confidence of these teenagers. Never, ever take the approach of humiliating, of putting down, of mockery. These things
make
will never
fun
help.
Of them.
Making fun, yeah. Don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Always approach it in a very respectful way. And building their confidence. Remember one thing, that the reason why they're doing this is because they want to achieve something. They want to be heard. They want to be seen, right?
Yeah.
If from a very young age, parents have noted this and they've tried their best to always make sure that they see their children, they note their children, then you find it's very much easier. When they become teenagers, children don't really pay attention to these things because they have realized that my parents have noted my perfections. Many of these young girls, they cross the boundaries of haram and they dress up and they try to achieve this body image because they think that they'll be now be seen by others and respected by others and given
yes.
that value by others.
Attention
by others.
Yes.
So the key is to make sure that we give them that attention at home. This is why home is there, right? Home is the place where they can be valued, they can be given attention to. So this is something we need to work on as parents.
All right. So you're trying to say that in case we give enough attention to our children at home, they won't make efforts to be center of attraction in this society.
Exactly. That's the first point. Another thing that parents should do is to work with the children when it comes to social media. We've mentioned this previously as well, that social media is not something you can stop your children from going into. It's so prevalent in today's world that that's not something advisable at all. But very importantly is to train and equip your teenager with the skill on how to deal with social media, how to make sure that they understand what's happening in the world of social media.
Mm-hmm.
Why do people behave in a way that they behave in social media?
True.
Through analysis, through discussion, through talking about it in dialogue, basically, you can bring your teenagers to understand the world of social media better. Obviously, it requires for you to also be aware of these things through reading and through taking courses. And so through this discussion, it will really help and it will strengthen the teenagers into dealing with these things. And this is, I feel, extremely important.
All right. So one other point you said is that parents cannot stop their children from using social media. You said that's literally not advisable. What they can do is, first of all, do a research on that themselves and then make a supervision kind of thing, be aware or teach their children how to deal with it. Brother, I'll be talking to you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're saying that social media has made a kind of mentality that physical body is something that should look perfect. And to attain that perfection, boys and girls are doing so much. They're making, they're going for a lot of expenses, a lot of time wasting and so many things to attain that physical perfection, which brother said is due to lack of confidence and due to lack of attention that's not given in the families. And you also said how parents can control the use of social media. Is there any more tip you would like to give to parents to control that?
Another thing that is very important to do is to introduce children to role models.
Okay.
One of the causes that leads to children to behave the way they do to it is because the role models they have are not good role models. The role models that have the same attitude when it comes to physical appearance, role models that post themselves in a very bad way, very unethical and immodest way.
Immodest.
Fueling this idea that my body is very important, my body is where my success lies, my body is where my perfection lies.
Yes.
And so what's important is for us as parents to introduce children and youth and teenagers to role models that will teach them where success is. Mm-hmm. So role models is a person who has achieved success in the eyes of the person who's following him. And this leads them to be influenced by the same goal and the same principles and the same ethos that this person has. So if you introduce them to really amazing role models who have the right values, then a teenager will be more inclined towards those. And it doesn't necessarily have to be role models of only Islamic background, for example. Right? Obviously, our first and perhaps you can say first and
choice.
Only role models are the Ahlul Bayt,
having
attained the highest level of perfection possible for any human being.
True.
And so these are the individuals, peace be upon him, and their families whom we follow
and
who we take our role models. But teenagers need to, for them to understand this takes some time. And obviously we need to work on it. But at the same time, you could talk about other role models as well that would at least reduce the damage that can cause by the celebrities out there that are brainwashing our children. So it can be successful individuals, but individuals whose success hasn't been their body image, has been other things. So for example, individuals who have worked for a noble cause.
Okay.
Take someone like Malcolm X, for example, or Nelson Mandela, for example, or individuals in the Islamic world as well.
Well, like today, there are so many youth who have created their own NGOs, the charity NGOs who are helping others. We can also introduce them as their role models.
Yes. In a way, just to show them that, look, there are success stories beyond just this physical this physical body that we're trying to put across. And this is something they need to understand. And once they understand, and in addition to that, if you're able to then keep them busy doing these activities, working, this will really help reduce the extravagance in attention to our physical bodies, to keep them busy and doing real things.
Yes, because empty minds are basically a very good host for Shaitan as well. Thank you so much, brother, for being with us. Thank you so much to our listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions for us or any suggestions, comments for our program, please feel free to contact us on English Radio at the rate of IRIB.IR. You can also search us on our social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. In case you want to listen to our programs again, you can go back to our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi aman Allah. God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Uber Files has been released, and it looks more like a rap sheet than anything else, from tax dodging to lobbying diplomats and foreign dignitaries to price manipulation. And from what we did at this Economic Divide program, this may involve dodgy financial accounting reporting. Hi, I'm Kavit Hathaway. Welcome to Economic Divide. Today's program is about the Uber Files. Some of the topics that we'll be covering in today's program, the Uber leaks. It was reported that they broke laws, they duped police, and they exploited violence against drivers. Just some of the things that the Uber leaks revealed. Another highlight of the program, the strategy behind Uber. It undercut tax-free markets. It lobbied for new laws in order to protect them. And it also paved the way for the Uber application to be installed with the general masses. Of course, that produced controversies within itself. And finally, Uber friends, politicians and barons, they acted against their own citizens. That is the cost of being friends with Uber.
Uber is a tech giant that provides mobility services globally. It allows users to book a car and a driver for transportation. Its services also include food delivery, package delivery, couriers, and freight transportation. The company is based in San Francisco, with operations in approximately 72 countries and 10,500 cities. Over the years, it has come to be known as a reliable service, with 118 million monthly active users worldwide. With 19 million trips per day, generated over $17.4 billion in revenues in 2021. But Uber's success is not only due to the creativity and ingenuity of its founders.
In short, digital platforms have massive potential. They offer working flexibility, they create jobs, bring innovation, and cater for what is clearly a strong consumer demand. However, people are the heart are at the heart of this business model. They deserve the same protection and conditions as any other worker in any EU country, including access to collective bargaining and representation.
Uber technology, as it is called, is known to be a ride-sharing application, among other things. But the funny thing about this company is that there's more negative material out there than positive information on it. Then came the Uber files, and boom, that just pushed the controversies over the top. These are some of the things that people have said online about the company. First, to rig the marketplace so a company with $20 billion in financing but no actual competitive advantages could destroy operators who were willing to obey existing laws but had much less financing. Our next tweet comes from Chile, or on Chile, which says, following Italy, trying to bring down the government, taxi drivers protest against Uber licenses and the price of fuel. The Uber files prove that WEF connections allowed them to fund trading at a loss to force small businesses out of business. Well, talk about Italians. They are saying no to human beings' modern slavery, as it's been described, which is an oppression to drivers by Uber. And finally, we needed to take a look at the Uber files itself in terms of how it was described by the whistleblower who came forward, where it said, as a title, "We sold people a lie."
My name is Mark McGann. I'm a former senior executive at Uber, and I'm here as a whistleblower. I'm the one who revealed what's become known as the Uber files. I've worked in highly stressful environments before. Uber was very different. It was very intense. Threats, violence, death threats on social media. And it's only when you come off that kind of hamster wheel and you take a step back that you realize how crazy it all was.
Ouch, that's gotta hurt. That's how this has been described. Let's introduce our guests, though, and see what they think. Sergio Avedian is a senior contributor at the Rideshare Guy who joins us. Sergio Avedian, welcome. Looking at this ride-sharing application by the name of Uber, it has its enemies not only within the U.S. but outside the U.S. The expansion that took place across the world was rather phenomenal, where hundreds of leaders in dozens of countries were courted. It included, obviously, politicians. But didn't the politicians act with regards to Uber in a way that it sacrificed their own citizens?
It obviously did, right? So all the existing cab companies, let's say, because when Uber first showed up, they showed up as a disruptor. Disruptor meaning they wanted to revolutionize public and personal transportation, which they have done. In some cases, obviously, not that the documents show, illegally, and in some cases, risking the lives of their own drivers. While we know what happened as far as in Europe is concerned, as well as the United States, that cab companies were not happy about this because Uber, is not a regulated company. While cab industry in all over the world is regulated industry by the local and state authorities.
All right, let's bring in our Professor Joe Haslam and see what he thinks. We welcome him, Executive Director of the Owners Scale Up Program at IE Business School in Madrid, Spain. Professor Joe Haslam, welcome to Economic Divide. Uber followed some unscrupulous business ethics, to say the least, in which taxi and cab markets were put under pressure. Governments were pushed to rewrite laws, and also we're looking at an app-based gig economy model of work that has since proliferated across the world. What is there to say that this is not going to happen in other industries within those countries who are, in essence, harming its workers?
Yeah, it's a great question. But the issue is, of course, is that the fun will continue until the money runs out. And a lot of these gig economy companies, these apps, super apps, whatever you want to call them, have been funded by venture capital. The idea that you invest for growth instead of profit and that you drive out all competitions and then raise prices. However, we're now at a period at the end of cheap money where it's not going to be possible anymore to fund these companies indefinitely. So I think there would have been a problem if we weren't at the end of cheap money, but I think the situation will sort itself out.
The fact that Uber's IPO was not the success story that it should have been isn't really about the fundamentals of the company today. It's more about the fact that their valuation got too high too fast in the past, and that severely constrained their ability to set a fair price for their value for their IPO when they went public.
It's time now for the info news section of the program. Our first item surely will catch your attention, and it is about something that actually relates to the Ukraine conflict. It's called deglobalization. That's right. World economy at risk of deglobalization based on what the IMF has said. Now, Russia's military operation in Ukraine and Western sanctions on Moscow, well, they might push the global economy into geopolitical fragmentation. That's kind of a dark side scenario that is another consequence of the Ukraine conflict. Next up, Kenya. Kenya's economy is our focus in this particular post that we brought out for you. Debt shadow clouds Kenya's forthcoming presidential polls. So obviously, as usual, the economy is what drives a poll or an election in this case. Kenya's economy at this point is Africa's sixth biggest, but its debt is up to two-thirds of the GDP. So debt plaguing Kenya is obviously a big burden on the economy there, not to mention other countries in Africa. Our next post is very dangerous in terms of the unity of Europe as a whole. That is our focus, where Europe's fight to stay united over the war in Ukraine, that's actually is being put to the test. That has been going on for some time. Now, Europe as a whole is now forced to wrestle with soaring inflation. We know that. The bloc is not as united as it seems, and we are seeing, obviously, the gas stoppage from Russia, which has amounted to quite a bit, especially for a country like Germany, to break this unity at this point, which seems to be inevitable in some senses. Next up, we go to the United States, a pact by the name of Schumer and Manchin. It's a tax and spending deal that they call the Inflation Reduction Act, in which new taxes and price controls to pay for green corporate welfare for the politically favored is the focus. Now, the question that many are asking is their aim to reduce inflation by chilling business investments and the economy? So obviously there's hidden factors that others are seeing in this pact between the two. Those were the ones that we picked in terms of news for you with the flavor of the economy in it. Of course, we would appreciate it if you... Hello and welcome to our in-depth section. Uber as a company has been filled with controversies, no doubt about that. Now, aside from these controversies, in this in-depth section, we actually wanted to find out if Uber was profitable or not. I mean, that's a simple approach here, but yet a very important one. In other words, was it making money or was it still incurring losses? Well, we found out even that is a challenge in itself. For example, in the year 2019, this is what the company actually reported. The headline read, how can a company lose $5.2 billion in revenues of $3.2 billion? Uber is going to show you how. $5.2 billion in revenues, $3.2 billion is what actually came out of that in terms of losses. Now, that is the question that comes to mind. How can the company actually lose $5.2 billion when the revenues were only $3.2 billion? Now, breaking that down is actually very hard, and digesting it is actually harder, but here is what the profit and loss comes into view for the operation of Uber. We went back all the way to the year 2014 and then went all the way to the year 2019. The ones in the blue are the profits. The ones in the red are the losses. The thing is, Uber reported sales of only $3.2 billion. In other words, the net loss actually exceeded, again, sales by $2 billion. The loss of $5.24 billion added to the loss of $878 million in the first quarter. So overall, Uber lost $6.25 billion in the first half of 2019. Total revenue for the two quarters was $6.3 billion. All right, next up, let's fast forward to November 2021. Another shocking headlines. In this case, in point, we're going to tell you what that means. Uber reports a loss, even as revenue jumped 72%, $5.9 billion losses from three of their other operations that they just splashed money onto, Didi Global, Grab Holdings, and Aurora. Again, $5.2 billion in losses. The revenues jumped, according to them, 72%. But thanks to its $3.2 billion loss in those three ventures, that was called the write-down. The amount, again, $5.2 billion. It said that this loss was due to unrealized losses from these stakes that I just mentioned. So there you have another headline where the numbers just don't add up in terms of the conclusion that is being reached. Now, we then proceeded actually to look at the figures from the actual books at Uber in terms of its profit and loss statements. Well, this is what we found out. Uber's fourth quarter and full year results for the year 2021, very recent, gross bookings at $25.9 billion. That's up 72% year over year. Net income recorded $892 million, which is almost $1 billion. That's the actual, figures that is the most current that we had based on what Uber actually reported, which projected a gross bookings of, as we mentioned, $25.9 billion with a net income of $892 million. Now, let's move on to the company CEO, Mr. Khosrow Shahi. That's right, he's Iranian origin. He has said that Uber's driver base is, from what he has said, at a post-pandemic high to explain some of the high figures or the profitability projection. And he said that it expects engagement to continue without significant incremental incentive investments. He has to say that. See, people have to realize that because he has to show that there's momentum in the money that Uber is making and also at the same time explain the loss, but that it's moving forward in terms of the money that the company is actually making. If you didn't understand that, that's okay. Let me bring in Sergio Avedin. He's the senior contributor who rejoins us at the Rideshare Guy. All right, Sergio Avedin, welcome back to Economic Divide. We are looking at this leaked trove of confidential files. Lots of revelations there. It flouted the laws. It duped police. Things that you're very much familiar with. At this point, why was there such a drive then behind Uber to go to these lengths to offer a service which sounds like it shouldn't be so intricate when it comes to a ride-sharing application? What are your thoughts on that?
Thanks for having me on. I'm from the first day, actually, all the way to today, Uber doesn't call itself a rideshare company to start with. That's just a word that just came around. They call themselves a technology company. So the reason for that is because they have been breaking the local city and state and federal laws, labor laws, transportation laws from their inception. So to me, you know, this is not that much of a surprise. These documents have been floating around for a while. I've known about these documents for a while. You know, look, they have to do what they have to do. You know, they went to lengths of breaking laws, obviously, and lobbying efforts. And as we know, in politics today, lobbying is in every issue is very strong. I'm not condoning what they did, but they were also trying to protect close to 50, 60, at some point, $100 billion worth of market capitalization.
All right, thank you very much, Sergio Avedin. Perhaps he gave us a bit of a background behind the numbers that we just covered. All right, let's bring back Mr. Joe Haslam, Executive Director at Owner Scale Up Program, who rejoins us from Madrid, Spain. Welcome back, Joe Haslam. We're trying to find out an explanation behind the numbers that Uber has offered, behind the way that the company has acted in terms of not only its operations, but also in terms of the aggressive global expansion that it has gone through. How do you explain the way that Uber has acted, and why has it gone through such lengths to offer what appears to be a ride-sharing application?
No, a lot of this comes down to the Silicon Valley philosophy of rugged individualism, much of which comes from Andrew Ryan, who's a philosopher who wrote books like The Fountainhead. They kind of believe that existing structures hold back progress. I mean, if you talk to Silicon Valley, the cliche is often, you know, we're changing the world, we're making the world a better place. And it isn't until after they've left these companies that they start to see the destruction they've left. So while in the beginning, everyone sort of talks to the people, talks to the authorities, very quickly they get frustrated and they change their approach, which is to let's just launch and see what happens. I mean, Facebook called this move fast and break things, but it's the same philosophy that applies in Uber. So they have a playbook whereby they go to a city and then they just start launching the application. And then they hope that they can get enough support from the public that the politicians then won't shut down the service.
Massive corruption involving Uber and its dirty practices have now emerged that show the company's success was not really down to standard business practices. The case, which has come to be known as the Uber Files and involves more than 124,000 company files, has shed light on the unscrupulous methods used by the company. The files, which are from the period 2013 to 2017, include correspondence, emails, company presentations, and text messages to elected officials.
One of the officials who was secretly consulted by Uber for illegal business advantages was Emmanuel Macron, the then economy minister of France in the government of former President François Hollande. Uber cut a secret deal with Macron to help the company get away with tight regulations of the sector, seen with the current CEO of Uber, Dara Khosrowshahi. So what were those secrets? This is what Ramin Mazohiri, our correspondent in Paris, said.
Macron apparently held secret meetings which resulted in secret deals that undermined laws created to regulate Uber, satisfy taxi drivers, protect passengers, and honor the national labor code.
Let's break down what Uber is actually guilty of here. The secret deals that involved Macron and Uber were as follows. The goal to undermine laws created to regulate Uber safety, satisfy taxi drivers, protect passengers, and honor the national labor code. Macron also helped Uber consolidate its position in France. The company also approached other top politicians, including then U.S. Vice President Joe Biden and George Osborne, the U.K.'s former Chancellor of Exchequer. Apart from cutting secret deals with politicians, Uber is also accused of jeopardizing the livelihoods of many people. In some cities, Uber initially paid nearly 90% of drivers' hourly earnings in order to drive out competitors. That was essentially giving rides for free, which sent taxi drivers into economic despair. And finally, the controversy which drew the most attention from the drivers was the issue of employment status. Rideshare services Uber and Lyft defended their business model, fighting a law requiring them to reclassify their drivers as employees. The law requires businesses in the gig economy to reclassify independent contractors as employees eligible for unemployment coverage, medical, and other benefits, something both Lyft and another ride-sharing app and Uber have categorically refused to do. Here's one demo that took place in front of the Uber headquarters in San Francisco back in 2020.
All these companies, they're paying under a minimum wage. Protections that people fought for generations prior to this are getting tossed out the window under the language of freelance or flexibility. But if you can't pay someone minimum wage to do their job, you shouldn't have a company.
Why I'm saying no to 22 is because it doesn't do enough. It's really a facade by the companies to try to maintain their profits, to stay in the black instead of the red, and that comes at our expense.
The Uber Files is an example of how cheap money funneled in an extravagant IPO flooded the company with cash, which was unable to venture out into other arenas. Now, whether those other arenas were successful or not, that's a whole other story. However, in the process, politicians were courted and they were lobbied in order to make way for this business. Surprised? You shouldn't be. This is what's called capitalism at its best. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you on board. From Miko Vitafoy and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
America's role in spread of terrorism and violations of human rights around the globe. In this radio program, we shall examine the U.S. role in egregious violations of human rights and acts of terrorism around the world. Please stay with us for more. The United States is the biggest violator of human rights in the world today. On 27th of June 1981, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, a close friend and companion of Imam Khomeini, may his soul rest in peace, was seriously injured in an unsuccessful assassination attempt while delivering a speech at a mosque in South Tehran. This attempted assassination was carried out by the MKO terrorist group, which has been supported for decades by the US government in its act of terror in Iran and elsewhere. Just one day later, on 28th of June 1981, in a major terror attack, a massive explosion ripped apart the central headquarters of the Islamic Republic political party, martyring the head of Iran's judiciary at the time, Ayatollah Dr. Mohammad Hosseini Beheshti, and 72 senior officials of the country. And just 4 days later, on 2nd of July 1981, Ayatollah Qudusi, Iran's prosecutor general or director of public prosecutions, was martyred in another act of terrorism. Soon after this spate of terrorist attacks, the head of MKO terrorist group, Masoud Rajavi, some of his henchmen, together with Abul Hassan Bani Saad, the disgraced president who had been removed from office by a vote of no confidence in the Iranian parliament, the Majlis, boarded a plane and fled to Paris, France. They were dressed as women and had help from individuals who were loyal to the former Pahlavi regime. In fact, the pilot who flew the plane that took Rajavi and Bani Saad to Paris was the same pilot who flew the deposed Shah out of Iran for the last time in January of 1979. Thus, members of the MKO, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist group, fled Iran and made their way to Europe and to the United States, where they received support from various European and US administrations. During the eight-year imposed war on Iran, the MKO, or the Mujahideen Khalq organization, made a deal with the former Iraqi dictator Saddam, and the terrorist group's main base became established in Ba'athist, Iraq. The terror group actively participated in the eight-year war and helped the Ba'athist regime both in the front lines and for interrogation of Iranian prisoners of war, captured during the war. Their main job, however, was to gather intelligence, using their contacts within Iran to provide valuable information to the Ba'athist regime, information which was used in the Iraqi bombing and missile strike campaign against Iranian cities. The MKO terror group also took part in Iraqi army operations on the front lines. In addition to helping the MKO mount terrorist attacks against Iran, the United States openly sided with former dictator Saddam and entered into direct confrontation with the Islamic Republic of Iran forces in 1987 and 1988. The US provided the Ba'athist Iraq with logistic and intelligence support, facilitating Iraqi chemical attacks against Iranian targets. In one infamous incident in June of 1987, the Iraqi Air Force dropped chemical bombs on the northwestern Iranian town of Sardasht. On 28th of June 1987, the Iraqi Air Force dropped seven deadly chemical bombs on Sardasht. Two bombs fell in the crowded central bazaar of this small town, two further bombs exploded in the residential districts of Sardasht, and three bombs fell in the orchards surrounding the town. The resulting carnage was horrific. Out of a total population of 12,000 people, 8,025 were injured, many of them sustaining very serious and life-threatening injuries. 130 people were martyred on that day in Sardasht in northwestern Iran. The Ba'athist regime had used mustard gas in this cruel and callous attack. Mustard gas is a chemical agent which persists in the environment. If it enters the human body, its debilitating effects will last a lifetime, and there is no known cure or effective medical treatment for mustard gas inhalation. In another infamous incident, the US warship USS Vincennes targeted an Iranian commercial airliner with 290 people on board, traveling from Bandar Abbas, a port city in southern Iran, to the United Arab Emirates, with cruise missiles. Everyone on board that plane, including 66 children, were killed. When a cruise missile fired by USS warship USS Vincennes brought the plane down in the waters of the Persian Gulf. To add insult to injury, the US president at the time, Ronald Reagan, tried to justify this inexcusable act of savagery and even handed out a Medal of Honor to the commander of USS Vincennes. The United States has extensively violated human rights around the world and killed innocent people as collateral damage in wars, missile strikes and drone strikes, all under the cover of its so-called war against terror. No country on earth has made as much instrumental use of so-called human rights as the United States of America. America is well known for its egregious violations of human rights and terrorism around the world, but this bleak and dismal record extends hundreds of years back to the European colonization of the Americas, the genocide of the native population of North America, the American Indians, and the subsequent formation of the United States by their founding fathers, many of whom happened to be slave owners, bigots, and racists. Many of the major founding fathers owned numerous slaves, such as George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison. Others owned only a few slaves, such as Benjamin Franklin. And still others married into large slave-owning families, such as Alexander Hamilton. According to surviving documentation, at least 12 American presidents were slave owners at some point during their lifetimes, namely George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, James Monroe, Andrew Jackson, Martin Van Buren, William Henry Harrison, John Tyler, James K. Polk, Zachary Taylor, Andrew Johnson, and Ulysses S. Grant. 10 of the first 12 American presidents were slave owners, the only exceptions being John Adams and his son, John Quincy Adams, neither of whom approved of slavery. George Washington was the first president of the United States who owned slaves, including while he was president. White Europeans who colonized North America considered themselves a superior race, and in order to colonize America, they sought to systematically wipe out the native local population, the Native Americans, or the American Indians, as they are known. Millions of Native Americans were killed and various Native civilizations were totally wiped out or driven close to the edge of extinction in a ruthless European drive to dominate and to colonize North America. The genocide of Native Americans remained a moot point since a number of American historians have tried to portray the Native Americans as uncivilized savages who deserve what they got. Genocide was whitewashed under the guise of fighting savages. Tens of thousands of Africans were shipped in from Africa as slaves to work on farms and plantations in North America, with no pay or human rights of any kind, to boost America's economy. The economy of the United States was literally built upon slave labor. Racism, always part of U.S. history, is very much present in today's America. Killing of African Americans, particularly young black men, by U.S. police officers has become almost routine. We have all heard of Tamir Rice, Michael Brown, Daunte Wright, Andre Hill, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Tanisha Anderson, Eric Garner. So many promising young black lives wasted by police brutality. Racism and racial discrimination has become a fault line in U.S. society, polarizing and dividing America. Outside of the United States, the U.S. government has a shameful track record of human rights abuses and violations and supporting terrorism. A very interesting point is that America often cites its war on terror and spreading democracy as reasons for violating other people's basic rights and sponsoring various terrorist groups, both large and small. In 1973, the U.S. government helped Chilean General Augusto Pinochet to overthrow the popular democratic elected government of left-leaning Salvador Allende, effectively ending democracy in Chile for many decades. America regards South America and Latin America as its backyard and cannot tolerate democratic and nationalist governments in this region, which want to look after the interests of their own people. America has a dreadful record of backing military strongmen and dictators and military juntas in Latin America because that is very much in America's interest and allows the United States to plunder South and Central America's resources very cheaply. The U.S. has also harmed the peoples of the Far East, West Asia and South Asia by its nuclear bombing of the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan at the end of the Second World War, by its war in Vietnam in the 1960s and the 1970s, by its war in Korea in the 1950s, and by its support for the Israeli regime in the Six-Day War of 1967, as well as many other wars which the Zionist regime has waged in West Asia region in the 1980s, 1990s, and beyond. The Iranian people have paid a high price in their struggle against the United States in the past 70 years. In August of 1953, a CIA-planned coup d'etat toppled the popular nationalist government of Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, and the fugitive Shah, who had fled Iran, was once again installed on the throne as a puppet of the United States. For the next 25 years, the United States did whatever it could to prop up the Shah's regime and suppress the freedom movement in Iran, but ultimately it was the freedom-seeking Islamic movement of Iran under the leadership of Imam Khomeini, may his soul rest in peace, which succeeded in bringing down the Pahlavi regime, replacing it with a popular, democratic and Islamic government. After the triumph of the Islamic Revolution, the United States has continued its hostility towards Islamic Iran, plotting and scheming to overthrow the Islamic Republic. With its dreadful record of gross human rights violations in every corner of the globe and support for various terrorist groups, the United States accuses Iran of human rights violations and of backing terrorism. America's Iranophobic policies are meant to boost the sale of U.S. arms in this region, particularly to dictatorial Arab regimes, America's puppets, or allies as some would like to call them. The United States has long tried to dominate this region through a mix of political, economic and military means, with psychological warfare thrown in for good measure. The Iranian people have sacrificed a lot in their more than four-decade struggle against the hegemonic policies of the United States. But they refuse to bow to America's excessive demands, and their continued staunch resilience towards this bullying power is quite remarkable.